Thank you all for coming out here today. So I know I'm supposed to keep it quick. So what I want to do is give you a little bit of the big picture first behind the project that I'm going to be talking about, and then we'll delve into the slides, explanation and philosophy of mind. So let me do a little big picture off the slides first. The big picture goes like this. Back when the world was young in the 1990s, there was this beautiful picture in philosophy of mind about how analytic functionalism was this grand synthesis that was going to give us the perfectly fitting metaphysics of the mind. So according to the story, back in the day, hundreds of years, philosophers were trapped in a spooky Cartesian dualism, and then came the logical behaviorists, people like Ryle, who showed how you could have a physicalist theory, but didn't have the resources to recognize our inner mental lives. The story continues. Then came the identity theorists, like Place and Smart, who showed how you could have a physicalist theory and have inner mental lives by identifying mental state types with brain state types. So pain was identified according to the somewhat mythological story with C fibroblasts. But then, people like Putnam and Porter showed that this identity theory was unable to make sense of the multiple realizability of the mind, of the fact that creatures who didn't have C fibers could still feel pain, but could just realize pain in other ways. And so functionalism emerged, analytic functionalism, as the synthesis of these developments in philosophy of mind, where an analytic functionalist said that, and this is a particular rendition that I'll be working with, they said pain equals DF, the state that is typically caused by such and such things like tissue damage, and typically has such and such effects, like saying ouch and wincing and running away. And this was supposed to be a physicalist friendly theory that was compatible with our having inner mental lives and was compatible with the multiple realizability theory. And so, the beautiful story ended. We have now come to a physicalist-friendly understanding of the place of mind in nature. Like all beautiful stories, there were some elements of truth to the story, but there were problems as well. And so, not long after the rise of analytic functionalism, came the fall of analytic functionalism. And there were a number of objections that got voiced. Jagwon Kim was concerned with whether analytic functionalism could make sense of the causal work that the mental does in the world. Other people were concerned about how to reconcile analytic functionalism with our introspective access to our mental states. But probably the most influential objection to analytic functionalism is concerns whether it can give an explanation of conscious experience. So, according to the a kind of explanatory gap theory that as targeted to analytic functionalism, if we say that pain is the state that's causally intermediary between, say, tissue damage and saying ouch, it seems like there's a particular phenomenal feel that you get when you pinch yourself, and then there's another phenomenal feel you get when you're tickled. And it seems like we could imagine people who are inverted with respect to the pain and the tickling feeling. People who, when they're pinched, experience that tickle feel, and then that tickle feel causes them to say ouch. So they seem to have states that satisfy the functional role of pain, even though what they're feeling is actually a tickle. So the question arises for the analytic functionalist, how can you explain why pain feels that way? And so it was thought that the analytic functionalist is unable to explain why pain feels that way, is unable to explain why a regular pain sufferer, like you and I presumably, and an invert who feels tickle feelings when pinched, is unable to explain the difference between those cases and that doesn't recognize. So what I want to do is argue that we can have a kind of a next grand synthesis that takes some of the functionalist insights, but repackages functionalism not as an analytic principle, not as a definition of the meanings of mental state terms, but rather as a grounding thesis. Grounding is this top new toy in metaphysics, where grounding is supposed to be the relationship that connects the more fundamental aspects of reality to the less fundamental aspects of reality that, as it were, are dependent and derivative from. So if you think, for instance, that the world has some physical features, let's just pretend that some atoms move around in the void, and you think the world has some chemical features like H2O molecules, you'll presumably think there's some connection between that, how these particles swirl around in the void and the H2O molecules. And as long as you think there's some connection, you'll want to posit a connecting relation between the underlying physical stuff and the higher level chemical stuff that's grounded. So that connection, this is the term grounding, that connection is a grounding connection, and grounding is an attempt to articulate the relation between the lower level and higher level portions of reality. So instead of thinking of functionalism as a definition of mental state types, I want to think of it as a way of understanding the grounding connection between the physical and the mental. And I'll claim that that way of understanding functionalism preserves all its advantages. We'll get a physicalist-friendly theory that gives us inner mental lives and allows for multiple realizability. We'll avoid all the disadvantages. It resolves the complaint about causal relevance, and it can bridge the explanatory gap. That's the big picture. That's what I'm going to try to do. This is one of these, like, if you just change it from analytic functionalism to ground functionalism, you solve all the problems kind of play. Maybe there's some problems, but that can come out in Q&A. For present purposes, given restrictions on time, I'm just going to focus on the part about the explanatory gap. So I'm going to first talk about metaphysical explanation. And then I'm going to give you the theory of ground functionalism and show how it does provide a metaphysical explanation for conscious experience. So in particular, what I'm going to be doing for the bulk of this talk, first half of the talk, is I'm going to just walk you through some kind of paradigm pieces of metaphysical explanation just to give you a feeling for how metaphysical explanation works. Then I'm going to theorize a little bit based on this prior basis, as to how metaphysical explanation works. We'll see that the kind of demands that people like Chalmers impose with the zombie arguments, that go through supervenience and not grounding, don't impose the right constraints on metaphysical explanation. And so then I'll show you how we can get a physicalist-friendly view of the mind that meets this theory of metaphysical explanation that I'm putting forward. So that's what we're doing. So I'll start with some examples. First example, drawing from set theory. This is any recursive conception of set theory, such as ZFC, in which we think of the sets as generated recursively by an operation set formation. I'm not saying that's the right way to think about the sets. I'm saying if you like this way of thinking about the sets, you'll naturally get some explanatory claims out of your set theoretic machinery, because claims that go back to this. On the way that I'll implement ZFC here, or any kind of recursive set theory, this isn't the only way to do it, but here's how I'll do it. We're thinking of set formation as this operation. You can think of it like this machine. And what this machine does is you have this input slot, you feed some inputs into the slot, some plurality of inputs go into the slot, and it spits out at the output end a set whose members are all and only the things in the plurality that you fed. And it's recursive. So the output slot, there's a little conveyor belt that goes back around to the input slot, and everything goes back in, and you keep building cells. That's how set formation works. So we can think of this theory as associated with the following ontology. It's got some fundamental elements. In pure set theory, it would be just the empty set. In impure set theory, we add in some other elements, like we have Socrates, jam Socrates into the input slot of the machine. We've got derivatives. These are the non-empty sets, the things that at some stage in the operation of the machinery come out of the output slot of the machine. And we've got this principle, set formation. This machine is the set form machine. And in particular, if you were to grab Socrates, jam the poor guy into the machine, you get out, the machine would spit out singleton Socrates. That's how it goes. And claim, see how this machinery works, and you'll see how singleton Socrates is generated from and dependent on Socrates. If you didn't have Socrates around or kind of grabbed him and shoved him into the machine, you'd never have gotten out singleton Socrates. And more importantly, I think we get the following explanatory. We can understand why singleton Socrates exists, given that Socrates exists, via set formation. So if you were surveying your ontology and you looked up to Platonic heaven and you said, whoa, Singleton and Socrates, how did I get such a thing in my ontology? Here would be an excellent way of answering that question. You got Singleton Socrates in your ontology because you have Socrates in your ontology. Never mind how you got him. You got somehow or other, you got Socrates in your ontology. And you have this operation, set formation, that takes things and spits out things. That's the story of how Singleton Socrates comes into the world. That's an explanatory story. Second example, Myriology, atomistically conceived. Well, I already gave a little bit of a warm-up for this example of the H2O. So we think, this is a particular way of thinking about atomistic myriology. We think this is actually the best way of thinking about myriology, but this is just to exhibit how you can get a certain kind of metaphysical explanatory structure. So we're imagining now a theory that, unlike classical myriology, insists that there are atoms, myriological simples, and treats these as the fundamental inputs to the myriological composition machine, and spits out compounds through an operation of myriological composition. So myriological composition is an operation that takes in any plurality of entities and spits out the myriological fusion of those entities. So if you have an H, and an O atom, two hydrogen atoms and an oxygen atom, and you spit them in to the myriological composition machinery, they spit out the fusion of those three things. Maybe there's further constraints on being an H2O molecule, like it has to be arranged and bonded in the right way. Let's suppose those constraints are met. I'm not going to be concerned here with whether composition occurs universally or only in restricted circumstances, or even should it occur universally, what added conditions you need to make the resulting fusion fit to be called an H2O molecule rather than an arbitrary scattering of an HH and O atom. So these guys just happen to be arranged and bonded in the right way. Sorry. And claim, you can now see through the machinery of myriological composition that the H2O molecule is generated from and dependent upon the H, the other H, and the O atom from which it's compounded. And more importantly, I think this licenses a certain kind of explanatory understanding. You survey your ontology, or you walk into a chemistry lab, or what have you, and you come to understand that there are H2O molecules in the world. And you start wondering, why are there H2O molecules in the world? How did they get there? H2O molecules aren't fundamental. There ought to be a story about why there are H2O molecules in the world. And the claim is, this kind of machinery gives you an explanatory story as to why there are H2O molecules in the world. So, why are there H2O molecules in the world? Well, because there's this H, that H, and that O atom in the world. Never mind how they got there. Maybe they're fundamental or, well, in fact, maybe there's a deeper story here. But from this perspective, these are in the world. And we have this operation of theological composition classes that fuses them. So now the claim is, this kind of machinery allows us to metaphysically explain why there are H2O molecules in the world. This is a satisfying, we have a satisfying explanation for why Singleton Socrates is to be found in the world, and a satisfying explanation for why there's an H2O molecule to be found in the world. Last example, wrong direction. Last example, somewhat more controversial and high tech, but important for some things that are going to come, is Bohmian quantum mechanics via David Albert's wave function realism. Don't worry, you don't have to follow the technical details. I'll give you a broad brushstroke picture of what's going on. According to Albert's wave function realism interpretation of quantum mechanics, in quantum mechanics, at least on some ways of thinking about the dynamics, the fundamental law, the dynamical equation, Schrödinger's equation, which tells you how this thing, the wave function, evolves across time. If you have a forget common sense, read your ontology off the laws approach to metaphysics, and you think quantum mechanics is a fundamental theory of nature, at least you'd be interested in what quantum mechanics being a fundamental theory of nature would tell us about the world. So then a natural thing to think is, well, read your fundamental ontology off the laws. The laws tell you how this thing, the wave function, evolves over time. So the wave function realist takes this approach very seriously and says the fundamental ontology, according to quantum mechanics, is the wave function, and perhaps one or two additional elements needed to make an explanation. make sense of what's going on. And the thing to understand about the wave function is it doesn't live in the three dimensions of space that you and I know and love. It lives in this vastly high-dimensional, 3n-dimensional space for n particles in the universe. So there's something like 10 to the 80th particles in the universe by the last estimate that I read. Who knows what they're saying now. But so it's like, you know, three times, it's a huge dimensional space. And this is not like some versions of string theory. We get the idea that R3 space is embedded in this like 11 dimensional space. It's not even that R3 spaces are three of the dimensions embedded in this huge space. It's just a totally different space. So this is weird. But okay. So on the Bohmian implementation of wave function realism, the fundamental ontology consists of two elements: the wave living in configuration space, and another thing also living in configuration space, the marvelous point, or the world particle. And that's just a special glowing point in configuration space. And what we want to be derivative from this theory is, ultimately, like tables and chairs, creatures like you and I, but let's at least see if we can get up to particles. That'll be, if we can get up to particles in three space, that'd be at least you think a natural first step to getting to 20 inches. And so people have challenged Albert as to whether the wave function realist can explain what's going on in three space, given that the fundamental ontology all lives in 3m space. And so Albert has a theory of functional enactment. And I'm doing this a little differently than he does. He does this kind of on the template of analytic functionalism, which I'm trying to break away from. So he thinks of this as part of the meaning of I'm not going to bother trying to trace the difference. I'm just going to present the kind of theory. So we've got a principle that says, the idea of functional enactment is that the world's occupying this position in configuration space, and the waves having such and such amplitudes causally enacts a system of so and so many particles moving in so and so many ways. So what Albert argues is that if you have the kind of wave function realist image of, say, a swarm of particles like this water glass here, then the causal interactions that we see in the wave function realist image of this swarm of particles will match, causally speaking, the kind of transitions that we expect with this swarm of trillions of particles arranged in this way. And we can state a precise principle of enactment, which says, given the position of the world particle in 3m space, we recover n particles in 3 space, and we recover the positions of the particles through the world's position at associated triples of coordinates. Again, I don't want to get too deeply into the details. What I want you just to see here is we've got a potential explanatory theory that's one of our leading accounts of fundamental quantum mechanics that says that we have an explanation for the behavior of particles from their locations in terms of the fundamental input is the wave and the world. And the principle linking the fundamentals to the derivatives is this principle of functional enactment. And so what I want you to now generalize from these examples, I want you to see that there are these grounding principles, these linking principles that were crucially connecting the fundamentals of the derivative entities in all the examples of metaphysical explanation that I gave. So in set formation, we have this operation of set formation that was linking Socrates to singleton Socrates. If we didn't have set formation, Socrates and singleton Socrates would just be these unrelated entities in your ontology with nothing linking them up. Likewise, in the case of the HH and O atoms and the H2O molecule, it was this operation of mereological composition that maps the HHO input to the H2O output. Without that operation or any sort of link between the atoms and the molecule, these are just independent entities with no particular relation to each other. And likewise, in the wave function realism example, we have the wave in the world as our fundamental inputs, particle positions in free space as our derivative outputs, and we need a link between the inputs and the output, and the link is given by, in this case, by the principle of functional enactment. So we have these principles, these, I call them grounding principles, that link the more fundamental inputs to the less fundamental outputs. And in general, I'd like to think that explanations trace dependencies in nature, and that dependence relations have this tripartite structure: the sources or the inputs, the links or the connecting principles, and the result, the output, the explanandum, the thing we're trying to explain. This is just as causal explanation links the causes to the effect by the laws of nature. So metaphysical explanation links the grounds to the grounded output by the grounding principles, or if you like, the laws of metaphysics. So that's the general picture for how I would encourage you to think about explanation and think of metaphysical explanation as a special case. We can get more formal about this, but I think I won't for purposes of time. This is, I think, the best way to think about both causal and metaphysical explanation through the technology of structural equation models. If you know what structural equation models are, you'll see what I did here. If not, don't worry about it. But let me just briefly say what we can do with this without walking you through how. Here I'm trying to model mass inheritance. Right. So here's a fact about H2O molecules. They have a mass of roughly 18 Daltons. And here's a fact about H atoms and O atoms. H atoms have a mass of roughly 1 Dalton, and O atoms have a mass of roughly 16 Daltons. And here's an interesting fact. This is a substantive claim about how mass works in the world. It's actually true in Newtonian mechanics, but false in relativistic theories. Mass is active. So at least in a Newtonian system where mass is additive, we would have a mass addition principle that links the mass of the H, H, and O to the mass of the H2. And once you're told the masses of these inputs, the H, the H, and the O, and the crucial additional fact, true in Newtonian mechanics, false in relativistic physics, that mass is active, you are now in position to solve for the mass of the H2O molecule. You now know that it's roughly 18 molecules. If you want to know why the H2O molecule has a mass of 18 molecules, here's the answer. It's because the H and the H and the O have masses of 1, 1, and 16, and because the principle of mass inheritance in Newtonian mechanics is at this addition. So, in general, I'm urging the metaphysician who wants to not just list what there is, as Quine asked us to do, but to go further and to explain why the world has the features that it has. The metaphysician who wants to think of metaphysics as an explanatory project, which is sort of my big project, to give an ontology that has the shape of an explanatory theory. So I've said that an explanatory theory, in the cases at hand, has the following structure. We have some fundamental inputs. We have some machinery, sometimes recursive, sometimes not, that takes in inputs and spits out some outputs. And we explain the outputs through the inputs and the machinery. Okay. So now that I've told you a bit about how I think metaphysical explanation works, let me tell you how I think we can do it in the case of conscious experience and the philosophy of it. So let me now state ground functionalism. Phenomenal states are grounded via a functionalist principle. So I'm now saying what that linking principle is between involved with phenomenal states. A subject S is in a given phenomenal state P in virtue of S being in a state which occupies P's functional role. It's kind of exactly what you'd expect if you transpose functionalism into a grounding framework. So just to, maybe it'll help to do it a little less abstractly. Illustrative example. Suppose the functional pain is to be caused by tissue damage and cause voice. Suppose that, in my case, it's the firing of my C fibers that occupies this functional role. Then, according to ground functionalism, the firing of my C fibers grounds my pain. So here I am, in a certain brain state. Oh, C fiber is firing. That state of C fibers, the firing of my C fibers, plays this functional role in me, and that's what, as it were, authorizes that input state, my C fibers firing, to generate this output state, my feeling. So this is no analysis is being given of the notion of pain. I'm not saying that pain means anything other. I think what it means is just some kind of feeling. No claim of analysis is made. Rather, a claim of grounding is made. So just like set formation is an operation that takes a plurality of inputs to a certain output, the set form of those inputs, this is describing an operation that takes in some lower level state of a system, in this case I won't say a physical state, and spits out a mental state. Another useful comparison is with nomological dualism. This is the way Chalmers addresses dualism. Chalmers posits, he thinks that the mental and the physical as metaphysically independent fundamental posits, but he says we need to explain the correlations, of course, between the mental and the physical, and so what he just posits is a new law of nature, nomological principle, linking phenomenal experience and functional awareness. So everyone agrees that the phenomenal experience and the functional awareness are correlated, and the question is what the basis is for the correlation. The dualist, the analytic functional says they're correlated as a matter of meaning. The dualist says they're correlated merely nomological. The ground functionalist attempts to stake out an intermediate position, which says they're correlated metaphysically by these laws of metaphysics or therefore these grounding principles. They're not correlated by meaning, and they're not correlated merely nomologically as a contingent matter of our laws of nature. Okay, so this is a physicalist-friendly view. It allows that my C fiber firings could be the grounds for my experience of pain. It thereby fits the general view that I'd also call ground physicalism, which says that the mental is not fundamental, but grounding is. Of course, like all versions of functionalism, it also allows that ectoplasm could realize mental states, phenomenal states. So it's not physicalist requiring, but I think that's appropriate. It allows for the physicalism to be true. And now we get to the explanation of consciousness. So as I was saying in the beginning, it's long been thought that functionalist and other physicalist accounts of the mind cannot explain conscious experience because it's conceivable that the functional state could obtain without the experiential state. So it's conceivable that I could be in the state that's causally intermediate between tissue damage and wincing, but feel nothing at all, that's a zombie, or feel a tickle instead of that painful feeling, that's an invert. So we can conceive of the phenomenal states differing in all sorts of ways while preserving the causal transitions. In other work, I've talked more directly about the zombie argument and arguments from conceivability. But I'll quickly state what's going on with respect to those arguments, and then we'll give the explanation for experience. What's going on with these arguments, according to my ground functionalist, is that there's an inference in the arguments from conceivable to metaphysically possible that many people ask. And what Chalmers and other people typically reply is that is that people who question that inference are usually making a kind of ad hoc restriction on metaphysical necessity. So there's no principal reason for restricting metaphysical necessity. And what grounding theory is supposed to give you with this associated idea of these grounding principles or laws of metaphysics is a principled, natural way to think about a restricted sphere of metaphysical necessity. So just like nomological necessity is given by holding fixed the laws of nature, so once you've got the notion of laws of metaphysics, grounding principles, you are in position to recognize another kind of restriction on the sphere of the conceptually possible worlds, namely those conceptually possible worlds which hold fixed our laws of metaphysics. So going back to the Mariology piece, I think let's suppose that our world is in fact one in which composition occurs universally. Every single plurality, no matter how scattered and heterogeneous, happens to have a function. Doesn't matter. Just take that as an assumption. Then it seems to me that other views about when mereological composition occur, other views, such other views are conceivable. No contradiction follows from the nihilist supposition that composition occurs never, only in the general case of self-composition. No contradiction occurs from other intermediate suppositions that mereological composition occurs only in a specified restricted range of cases. It's conceivable that composition occurs in some other way. But holding fixed the principles of our world, which I just supposed are the principle of universal composition, then we'll get that it's metaphysically necessary, but not conceptually necessary, that composition occurs universally. Likewise, if we have a functionless metaphysical principle, then we'll get that it's metaphysically necessary that my C fiber firing, given that it plays this functional role in my organism, grounds my human pain, even if it's not conceptually necessary. So we get a principled way of pulling apart metaphysical from conceptual necessity, and for thinking of metaphysical necessity as a particular kind of restricted necessity, restricted by the grounding of themselves. But that's the zombie argument. What I want to just give you here is an explanation for conscious experience. So suppose that a particular conscious experience M is realized in a given entity, either, can make it a little bit multiple, given some multiple relativity here, there's two ways to realize an episode M. You can have states P1 and P2 together, playing their causal roles, or by P2 and P3 together, playing their causal roles. And so, did this through structural equation models. If you know what I'm doing with structural equation models, you can read the equations, but let me just talk you through the rough gist of what I've done here. These are the physical states, these are the inputs. This is the mental state, this is the output. I've imagined that these can all be just on or off. And I've set up an equation that says that the mental state, let's say this is feeling pain, that this gets set to on, feeling pain gets set to on, when either P1 or P2 is set to on, or when P2 and P3 are set to on. So that's what this max of two mins is. It's a it's an OR. It's either P1 or P2. Either P1 and P2 or P2 and P3. And so let's say that in point of fact, all these physical states are on. Now, just like in the case of the mass of the H2O, just as you were in position to solve for the fact that the H2O molecule has 18 Dalton's mass on the basis of the assignment of masses to the HH and O atoms. And just as that was an explanatory connection mediated through a grounding principle, so you are now in a position to solve, given that I am in these physical states, and given the function, given the grounding principle as expressed through this equation, whether or not I'm in pain. And you will get the answer in this case that yes, I'm in pain. And just as these were perfectly adequate structures for delivering metaphysical explanation in all the other cases of set formation and mereological composition and quantum mechanical case, so this is equally adequate in this case for expressing the explanatory connection between the physical state and the mental. And of course, I just did this with pain on or off, but I could have made this mental state variable more interesting. I could have had different intensities of pain. I could have had a value for this variable to represent a tickle feeling or various other phenomenal states. And then I would just set up a more complicated equation that connects the values of the physical state variables to whatever output I wanted from my mental state variable. So suppose I say that this can have three values, pain, tickle, or nothing. And I say that it gets to pain if all three are on, tickle if two out of the three are on, and otherwise nothing. Now I'm in a position to solve for the fact that to explain why I'm in pain rather than experiencing a tickle, or why I'm in pain rather than experiencing nothing, any of the distinctions we want to make among the phenomenal experiences that we enjoy or suffer from
can be explained in this model, and the claim is that this fits the general structure for what we want from metaphysical explanation. So what I tried to convince you of in the first half of the talk is that we want, for an adequate metaphysical explanation, we want something that fits a certain structure. And now I've given you something that fits that structure, uses this functionalist grounding principle, and gives you phenomenal states as its output. So I claim this is what an explanation of a totally adequate metaphysical explanation for conscious experience would look like. Further claim, more tendentious claim, if you think that there was something missing in this functionalist explanation for conscious experience, I claim you have put too stringent of a demand upon what's needed for metaphysical explanation, and we will see in the other cases of metaphysical explanation surveyed that other things like transparency, the conceptual necessity, just aren't to be found in some of these other cases. That's what I tried to convince you of in the neurology case, where I said it's conceivable that composition might fail to occur.
I'm going to finish up here. I won't do causal efficacy, but we can regain causal efficacy. And so I've argued that explanatory gap criticisms of physicalism rest on mistaken conceptions of metaphysical explanation that were largely theorized through conceptual analysis or notions of supervenience. And once we move beyond conceptual analysis or notions of supervenience to this new toy of grounding relations, we can develop views such as ground functionalism, which I propose as a physicalist-friendly explanation of conscious experience in a material world.